Is there TV or a radio on in the background?
No, that's the that hum is the computer.
No, I mean there's a sound coming from, like, the music coming from somewhere, I think.
That's not on this end.
Maybe it's here.
Maybe it's just the music of your soul you're hearing.
Why is my soul sounding like cha-cha then? So let's do a check-in on how we feel right now, and also maybe what we hope for with this conversation. I just did my morning workout and my morning meditation, so I feel here. I feel I'm here in my body, and I feel excited to have this conversation with you. And I'm thinking a lot about the documentary, the work you've been doing about you, and also about your TED Talk. So I feel inspired. I feel curious, and I hope to get to know you better, and I also hope to understand more of the depth and also the complexity of the issue of men's work and the work that both of us are dedicated to. And with that, I'm in.
Okay. My name is Eldra, spirit name Peaceful Bobcat. I'm present. I'm here. I'm in the moment. Emotionally, I can connect to joy, and I can connect to humility. I'm happy to be alive. I'm happy to have the opportunity to be in dialogue with a kindred spirit. And I'm humbled that whatever it is that I'm doing in the world that has been seen or is touching whoever it touches, makes an example that people want to connect with. For so long in my life, I was in a negative space, and the contribution I was bringing to the world and the people around me, as well as myself, was devastating. So to be on the opposite end of that spectrum is quite humbling, and I feel grace right now. I feel like I'm in a space of grace right now. So thank you for having me. And with that, I'm in.
Thank you. So I think it would be nice to start off by just getting to know where your dedication for this work comes from. How did it all start?
My dedication for this work started in New Folsom Prison. It actually goes back further. It goes back to my childhood, because that's where the seeds were sown. And in doing this work, that's what we do. We try and get to the root of things so that we can then reformat how I operate from those roots. But I got introduced to this work in New Folsom Prison after getting out of the hole, solitary confinement. Me and an associate had stabbed another prisoner. I was serving a life sentence in the California prison system. I did 24 years of a life sentence. I was sentenced to 17 years running consecutive with 7 to life. And when I went in, I was still involved in the things that I was involved in the community that got me sent to prison. So I was still gangbanging, still, you know, dealing drugs, running weapons, that sort of stuff. I was still a criminal. I was still engaged in my active criminal lifestyle. And I engaged in some activity, assaulting another man with weapons that resulted in me being sentenced to solitary confinement for a couple of years. And when I got out of the hole, I was sent to New Folsom, and they had a program there called Inside Circle. While I was in the hole, I had come to hit my personal rock bottom and decided that the lifestyle that I had been leading up to this point, I was a dozen years into my prison sentence at this time, I had come to the conclusion within myself that what I was doing was not working, because I was this far away from being on death row and hadn't killed anyone to that point. So when I got out of the hole, I went to, you know, what we call homeboys, people who are in my gang, and I let them know, man, you know, I'm done. I'm finished. I'm going to do something else with my life. I'm going to work on me and try and figure out what the hell is going on with me. And along that road, I was invited to join Inside Circle, and it opened me up like a hydrogen bomb going off. Just imagine my heart space just boom, exploding, and being smacked in the face with the reality of who I was, who I had been, how I had been showing up in the world, and then being supported in finding out the nexus for my thoughts and my actions.
So what happened emotionally when you attacked that fellow prisoner? Do you remember that sensation in your body? What was going on in you?
There was no emotion. I was at that point, I did not feel emotions. Let me backtrack that. The closest emotion that I could identify feeling on a regular basis was anger and rage. That was the only emotion that I would allow myself to feel. But when I was attacking and stabbing that man, I didn't feel anything because he hadn't done anything to me personally. He had done something to someone else, and I was just there as an enforcer to make certain that the job got done. So I had no ill will towards him. I had no anger, rage, hate. I was just a machine going through the motions. It was like, here's a target, needs to be killed, terminate.
Right. So it was more of a task getting done in some way?
That's it. That's just it, plain and simple. I had gotten to a point in my life and in my lifestyle that it was just, okay, there's a task that needs to be done, just do it. There's no emotion involved, because I had gone to a place where people were objects. So it's not like I was, in my mind and inside of myself, it's not like I was doing something that I, to someone that I identify as another human being.
Right.
In the way that someone with a conscience thinks about human beings, thinks about other lives, thinks about other souls. This is just somebody who's in the way who needs to be knocked down. They've transgressed in some way. They've broken a rule. And this is what happens when you do that. So you're next on the list.
Right.
It's very cold. It's very calculated. It's very callous. And that's where I was in my life at that time.
And did you belong to any group or gang inside as well?
Yes. Yes. I was a blood gang member on the outside, and I continued that while I was on the inside. So this was, you know, in connection to and to further the reputation and or honor of my gang.
Yeah. So, I mean that kind of, there's also the aspect of belonging. I mean to belonging to a group or belong to a meaningful narrative or to a belief system or to a set of rules that, I mean, in that place might be like the last thing that makes sense. Does that connect with you?
Are you referring to being in prison and wanting to connect to something, be a part of something?
I'm just thinking out loud that you were part of this gang, and the reason for you to reinforce a role or to act violently against a fellow inmate because that person broke a rule or something. I mean, that's like, it sounds like it's part of some kind of game that then makes sense to you while you're inside. I'm just trying to understand what happened, the whole yeah, part of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, now what I hear you trying to do is understand the mind frame of someone who's involved in the criminal underworld. And yeah, the mind frame there is there's a whole code of conduct, there's a whole belief system, there's a whole structure that I bought into.
Yeah.
And people who are a part of that buy into. It's a culture onto its own with encyclopedias worth of rules and standards. And honestly, it's a bunch of bullshit. There are a lot of codes, there are a lot of rules, there are a lot of regulations, and they are applied in not a fair manner. If you have power, if you have status, then you can get away with breaking rules that someone who may not have the same stature could possibly be killed for. So it's a lot of favoritism. There's a lot of nepotism. It's a lot of those things are put into place in order to crowd control, in order to mind control, in order to keep people functioning in a particular way out of fear. So it's manipulation. It's a form of manipulation. In the beginning, it comes across and it appears to be a structure of family, a structure of trust, camaraderie. And the deeper you get into it and the more that your mind opens, if you're open to that, you realize that, yeah, this is this is a bunch of garbage. And it's full of a bunch of cowards who are hiding and utilizing this to, you know, control or feel like they have some semblance of control because they don't have that anywhere else in their life.
Right. But it's still a system, right? It's still of a system.
Oh, it's very much so a system.
And lack of anything else, it's the only thing you have, right?
It's a choice. You know, it would be very easy to say, oh yeah, it's the only thing that you have, but like with anything else in life, it's a choice. Because you can also choose to walk away. You can also choose to not be a part of it. There are plenty of people who operate and function in prison and they're not parts of gangs, have never been parts of gangs, and they do just fine.
Yeah. Yeah. But that demands something else from inside of you, right? That demands that puts you in a position where you need to be grounded, right?
Like that demands that you have strength of character and that you're solid in who you are and you won't be moved off your square.
Yeah.
And you'll do and be who you are and you'll function for you and what's best for you.
And could you find that place within you in prison as well?
Oh, I got to that place within myself the last time I got out of solitary confinement. When I got to New Folsom Prison and I told them verbatim was, if you see me over in the corner and the Southern Mexicans are attacking me or some Crips are attacking me or some Nazis are attacking me, don't come to my rescue. Don't come to my aid. I got it under control. I got a plan. And because my brain worked the way that it worked, the people that I functioned with viewed me as someone who was smart. So they were like, okay, you know, this dude's always got a plan. So he must be up to something. Maybe this is an escape attempt or something. And so, you know, once I laid that out and they were like, yeah, okay. And I said, on the flip side of that, if you've got something going on and you're getting jumped on or you got something going on and you're politicking and there's some sort of fight, struggle or strike, don't look to me to come because I'm not coming. So that was me letting them know I'm on my own. Leave me alone. Don't expect me to engage in these rules. Don't expect me to engage in these politics. I'm no longer with this. And that was basically me drawing a line in the sand saying that I'm done with this. And if anybody has a problem with this, we can deal with this right here and now.
And what was the reaction to that from your former gang members?
It was accepted wholeheartedly. They respected that. They honored it. And quite frankly, as I look back and reflect, it was something that a lot of people in prison hunger to be able to do themselves. And we all get to that place within ourselves when we get to that. Everybody wants to be an individual. Everybody wants to have the strength to do their own program. But there's a lot of fear in prison. Prison promotes fear. And so there's a lot of fear to step out on that ledge, you know, amongst what are a bunch of sharks and predators and be on your own and have to just worry about protecting yourself and not having somebody else have your back. That can be a scary option for somebody in prison, especially if you've been a part of a gang and you victimized others along the way and you've created a lot of enemies. Now you're out there by yourself. Now you could be, you know, potentially prime meat for somebody who wants some sort of revenge on you.
And how many years did you do by yourself inside without the gang, without the group?
From 2001 until I paroled in 2014.
So 13 years by yourself? Yeah. And how did your days go about? How did you spend your days during those 13 years? What could a day look like?
Well, I had a job as a prison assignment as a porter, which is basically a janitor. I was involved in various self-help groups, so I was always going to different self-help groups, mainly inside circle, doing my own personal work, and I spent a lot of time out on the yard exercising and mentoring other individuals, trying to steer other individuals away ultimately from gangs. But if not getting out of the gang life, how can you make better decisions? How can you make less violent decisions that have you in the hole and jeopardize not just your program, but everybody else around you?
Right. I mean, I hear that you had a lot of time to think, to reflect upon your life, especially during your 2 years in the hole.
Yes, sir.
And I'm really curious about what you think about what was the root of your rage? What was the root of your anger and aggression?
The root of my anger and aggression goes back to my childhood and being molested by a babysitter. I was put in a position by he was maybe 17 years old. I used to be babysitted by a brother-sister combo. They were high schoolers. I was 6-7 years old, and my sister at the time, or 4 years my junior, we'd be babysitted. And oftentimes it was just the sister. And she'd put my sister to sleep, and then we'd lay on the couch, and she'd have me laying up on her chest while we were watching TV. She'd pretend like she was asleep. She'd pop a boob out. I'd suck on her boob, you know, 7 years old. Oh, it's cool. I'm sucking on high school titty, you know. And I didn't think a lot about it, and I didn't have the tools to understand what beliefs I was taking on. And from that, what I was taking on was that, you know, the belief that women were inanimate objects. That wasn't an intimate sort of thing. Number one, I was 7 years old. I didn't have the capacity to have that sort of relationship. And number two, I was being trained that people were inanimate objects. There was not a connection. That wasn't that sort of environment, and I was being taken advantage of. But her brother would sometimes come and babysit as well. And there was an evening where he wanted to have sex with me. And that didn't seem to be so fun to me. This wasn't his sister. This was a dude. And I declined. And he told me that if I wasn't interested, then he'd go into the other room and see what was going on with my younger sister. And so I capitulated. And so the seed that I have come to realize that was planted at that time was that I was in a position to be victimized, and my mind had me down as a weakling. My mind had me down as, because I cared for my sister, because I loved my sister and wanted to protect her, that put me in a vulnerable position. So me caring about her was a sign of weakness. And that brought about a lot of anger. I was angry at my sister for a long time and didn't realize it. I was angry at myself. I was angry at a lot of people and didn't realize it. So that's where the seeds were sown for a lot of my anger and rage and ability to victimize others and view others as objects, and determine in my head that in any situation in life that appeared to be threatening, that appeared to be dangerous, that appeared to be winner versus loser, predator, prey, I was going to be the predator, not the prey. I was going to be the victor, not the loser. I was going to be the one that was bashing in a skull, not the one getting his skull bashed in. Mm. So those were the seeds that were planted in me when I was, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old. And they just, you know, kind of set and were underneath the soil until the right situation came along and I, you know, went out into the streets and picked up the gang life. I was primed for that. I already had the attitude and the mentality. I didn't have to be trained on how to victimize somebody else because it was already instilled in me. It was already instilled in me to be a predator and to take advantage of people.
And did you have anyone to talk to about this? Did you tell anyone at all?
No, I didn't tell anybody about this. I grew up in a two-parent home. I had my mother and father in the home. My mother and father actually just celebrated their 50th anniversary this past August.
Nice. Wow.
I didn't know how to communicate something like that. And at that time in the 70s, you know, they weren't equipped with the tools to be able to recognize the signs, to know what sort of questions to ask. I do little things, you know, like break windows and stuff that at that time they would call boyhood shenanigans and things like that. But knowing what I know now, those were signs of a troubled youth, deeper than just, you know, boys being boys and going out and doing different little stuff. There were things that were signs of something deeper, but nobody around me was equipped to try and investigate and delve deeper into that. It's not a blame thing. It's just a fact.
Right. And how was your relationship to your dad? I mean, how was that masculine presence in your life? How was he and how is he as a man in your life?
Well, the relationship that we have today is very different than the one that I remember as a child. Mm. The one that I remember as a child was growing up with a father who was a Vietnam vet. He earned a Purple Heart in Vietnam. And when he came back, he was a drill sergeant. So I grew up in the house with a drill sergeant of the United States Army. His father before him was in the military and his brothers were military. So I grew up in a house with a lot of discipline and a lot of strict rules. And, you know, it was his way or the highway. There were rules and you stuck to them. You didn't question them. You didn't argue them. You just did what you were told. And if you did not, there were consequences. I grew up in an era where it was legal for corporal punishment in school. I can remember my parents signing, you know, the permission slip at the beginning of the school year, and we'd get SWATs in school with rulers, you know, for rule breaking. You'd get the option. You can get the SWATs here in school, or we can send a note to your parents and let them know what happened, and they can deal with it. And often it was, you know, you'd prefer the few SWATs with the ruler in school as opposed to the ass whooping you'd get at home for showing out in public and in school, which you knew better than doing and embarrassing the family.
Right. So during those formative years and after that horrible event with babysitters, you had this anger inside of you. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
And you didn't tell anybody about it. But you went into sports. You had some kind of outlet for that energy.
Yeah. I had sports as an outlet for energy and a way to mask. You know, sports was for me a very good way to mask, you know, who I was and what was going on and bury those sorts of things deep inside, because I was, you know, a fair to middling athlete. I was usually one of the, if not the best person on my team. So that's what people saw when I was engaged in athletics. They saw the prowess on the field. They saw the ability on the field, and that was lauded and applauded. And that's what people engaged with. And that was cool for me because I didn't have to engage with them. And when I say I'm talking about the real person didn't have to engage. The persona was engaging, and that's who people were engaging with. So that was another outlet for me to be able to hide.
All right. So they didn't get to know the real you and the different emotions and parts of you that was lying underneath the persona.
No.
Did anyone get to know that person?
No. Like I said, you know, my dad was in the military, and we're talking about at that time a Cold War era. So we did a lot of moving, you know, every 3-4 years or so, I'd be in a different place. So, you know, I'd say I was in Germany for 3 years. I remember being in Germany, and we lived in Noyon. We were there for a couple of years, and then we moved from there to Kitts again. So I can remember schoolhood friends and associates, but you're not around really long enough to develop lifelong relationships because everybody's always moving. Your parents are always being stationed someplace else around the world. So you get to know people, you get to like people and hang around with them, but it's nothing in depth.
And also something happened that prevented you from moving on with your sporting activities. What happened?
Me and a friend took his mother's car for a joyride one evening. We decided we were going to take, I was 14 at the time. We stole his mom's car. You know, they call it joyride, but it was a car theft. We stole his mom's car and took it for a joyride and wound up wrecking it. Wrecking a vehicle that had a for sale sign in the window. She was in the process of trying to sell it. So my parents split the cost of what she was trying to sell it for with her as their amends on my behalf. And so that summer, I had to spend doing, you know, various chores around the house. And I was restricted from playing baseball that year. So the sports were off the table. I was on, you know, summer long punishment. There were no sports, the activities like that. So I made the choice that summer to get involved in the gang lifestyle. And it was an easy transition for me because a lot of the people that were in the gang that I lived in the neighborhood that I lived in, I knew them already. I was already associated with them either through school or we played sports together. So these were people I had been around for a few years, and I knew what sort of activities that they were involved in. I was familiar with them. Some of them, you know, I could even utilize the word friend for whatever that's worth to 13, 14 year olds. And so the transition for me was real simple. That was another place to hide. That was another place where I could create a persona. That was another place where I could show something to others that was outsized and grandiose, and they would look at that and they would respect that, and I wouldn't have to show who I was. I could hide, and I could, you know, have, you know, what we used to, or I used to think was respect and honor.
And what was your position in the gang? What did you do on a daily basis?
Well, at that time, you know, 14 years old, there was not really a position that I had. It was for the most part, fairly fresh to a lot of us. I was in Sacramento at the time, and Bloods and Crips were founded in Los Angeles. So it was fairly new in the early 80s to the Sacramento area. So we were dibbling and dabbling in things that people from Los Angeles had brought up, moved up, and introduced to us. So it was, you know, I was engaged in narcotics trafficking, gun running, burglaries, robberies, assaults. Yeah, if it was illegal, we were into it. I was into it. And because of my brain, because of the way that my brain functioned and my ability to problem solve and come up with things quickly, it garnered me respect. My ability to think garnered me a lot of respect, because when you think about criminals are not the smartest people. We do dumb stuff. Criminals do dumb stuff. That's why we get caught. That's why prisons are full. And oftentimes there were issues that would come up and then there's a discussion. Okay, well, how do we do this? How do we go about this? How do we get this? And I always had the answer. I always had an idea about how to do something, how to accomplish something, how to overcome something. So that, you know, was something that garnered me respect and a position as someone who was seen in a positive light in that world.
And what was the last gang activity? I mean, what was the actual event that led you to be incarcerated?
The actual last event that led me to prison, because I was incarcerated multiple times before I actually went away for life. I was incarcerated as a juvenile for false imprisonment and possession of stolen firearms. I was incarcerated for burglary. I was incarcerated for car theft. And those were all before I turned 18. I did, from the time I was 14 to the time I was 18, I did 3 years of incarceration. I don't think I was on the streets in the community more than 6 months straight at any one time, from the time I was 14 to the time I was 18. Mm. I was incarcerated in some shape, form, or fashion. The crimes that netted me a life term were attempted murder and kidnapping for purposes of robbery. And I had gotten out of the California Youth Authority, which is young people's prison, 21 days prior to getting arrested on those charges. I got out October 10th, 1990, and I was arrested on November 1st, 1990. And the next time I saw civilization was June 18th, 2014.
Hmm. I mean, what I'm thinking about as I hear you speak is there's something here about order and chaos. and I mean, so sports going into sports is you join a group, there's a clear set of rules, and there's an us and a them, right?
Yes.
In the gang as well, there's a set of rules, there's a group, and there's an us and a them, and a clear purpose to what to do. And the same in, I imagine, in prison with the groups and the gangs there.
The groups, the gangs, the inmates, the guards, there's a us and there's a them.
Yeah. And if you carry a lot of chaos inside of you, maybe you look for a sense of order on the outside. Maybe you look for something to hold on to, something that makes sense, like a set of rules or a narrative or a purpose, a group purpose. And that helps you to navigate through that chaos that you carry inside of you.
It definitely was the case for me. Having structure negates that chaos. Mm. Whether it's real or imagined, it negates the chaos because there's a focus on something else. There's a focus on codes of conduct. There's a focus on rules. There's a focus on order. There's a focus on routine. There's a focus on the way that things should go. There's a focus on making certain that everything is in line and in place the way that it should be. And that is something that can distract me from looking at the chaos that is my internal life.
Yeah.
Because I'm looking out at what's going on everywhere else and trying to put everything in place everywhere else, as opposed to looking inside and put those things in place.
And when was the first time that you actually looked inside to that chaos?
The first time I actually looked inside into that chaos was when I was sitting in the hole. And because I'd been to the hole, I'd been in solitary confinement a few times before that, but because of my history in prison and the things that I had been engaged to up to that point, including the offense that netted me that solitary stint, I was placed on what was called stand alone, walk alone. And what that is you have what's called classification, and the classification committee, that's the warden, the captains, all of those sort of people, had determined that I was such a bad actor that I was not fit to be around other human beings, even other inmates, even other people who were in solitary confinement. Most people in solitary confinement, when you go out to recreation, you're with other people. You're in the hole, but you're with other people. I was in the hole, and I would go out to recreation by myself. I would live in a cell by myself. I was in a two-man cell, but they would not put another human being in the cell with me. They would not let me out on the yard with other people. And I was serving this term in Corcoran, California, in the SHU in Corcoran. And SHU is an acronym for Security Housing Unit. and the building was split into two halves. One side is SHU, Security Housing Unit, and the other side is FHU, P-H-U, Protective Housing Unit. And Charles Manson and Sirhan Sirhan were serving time in the PHU side. And they are two of the most notorious people in California prison lore. Charles Manson, you know, the famous Helter Skelter crap, and Sirhan Sirhan assassinated Bobby Kennedy. And they were allowed out around other people when they went out to recreation. And I'm looking and I'm thinking, here you got Charles Manson, who by his hand never did anything to anybody. He just word of mouth convinced other people to go and butcher other people. And they're letting him out around other people. But I can't be out around other people. For me, that was an epiphany that something about this is wrong. Something about where I'm at and the place that I've reached in my life, this don't make sense. If I then reflect on how I was raised, the household that I came from, you know, the advantages that I had in life that other people in my same situation did not have in their life, it was very obvious to me that the choices that I had been making to that point were ass backwards. And I didn't know what the change would look like, but I knew that I needed to start investigating what was going on, or without a doubt, I was going to die in prison.
And that's what you did when you went into the Inside Circle program.
Yes.
So I mean, I bet there's a difference in viewing your chaos or investigating your chaos alone and solitary and doing that in a circle.
It's very different, because investigating it in solitary, I was still a criminal. In my mind, I was still a criminal. And my real reason for walking away from the gangs was so that I could get to a lower level prison and escape. And I knew that continuing to be involved in the things that I was involved in, the spotlight was going to continue to be on me as someone who was viewed as a leader amongst his peers, and the gang still involved in, you know, selling drugs, jumping on people, doing all of that sort of stuff. It was going to be very difficult for me to get down to a lower level prison where I could then hatch my, you know, ingenious scheme to escape from the California prison system. So I had to be alone. I had to be someone who was flying under the radar. That was my initial goal. And along the line, Inside Circle found me, and I was thrust into a position to then begin to look at what was really going on with me.
Tell me about your first experience with Inside Circle, of that breakthrough experience.
Well, the first breakthrough experience that my first experience with Inside Circle, I wasn't personally doing work. It was when I was sponsored in, and after the process of sponsoring myself in and going through a round of check-ins, seeing a man do work. And I got the opportunity to sit and hold space with a man doing an extremely deep piece of work that I had been around for a decade on various prison yards. And I thought that I knew him or was familiar with him to a certain degree. And seeing just his raw emotion and his pain and what he had been through and the wails and the screams that were coming from, I have no idea where, deep inside of him, and seeing other men that I was also familiar with from other places hold and support that man and go into that place with him and then bring him back in a tender, loving, and caring way was huge. To me, I had never witnessed anything like that in my life. And then me stepping onto the carpet and doing my work and discovering where my trauma was, because that was something that I had buried in myself, you know. The account that I recounted to you about being molested, the very next time I talked about that and even was able to tap back into that and realize that that had happened was sitting in Circle. I was 34 years old. So that was something that, you know, when it happened, a piece of me got locked away and blocked off and walled off. And it was behind, you know, brick walls, steel, iron, barbed wire. It was behind all sorts of stuff. And it got cracked open on that carpet. I didn't even, you know, if somebody would ask me when I was 25, if something like that had ever happened to me, I'd have said, hell no. And in my mind, I would have believed that. That's how far deep it was buried.
Yeah, and I get why there's so much about that experience that is hard to carry yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what therapy and family and relationships and support and circles are for, to help you to be able to visit that. Not by yourself, to get the support to be, you know, courageous enough to visit that trauma.
Yes.
And also what strikes me is that in these groups, I mean, both in the sporting activities, in the gang activities, in the prison activities, I mean, in all these groups, there are men, boys, guys, right? And there's also an aspect of what is referred to in society as toxic masculinity. And I heard your TED Talk on that topic as well. I'm having trouble with that wording. I'm having trouble with that concept.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I don't see the problems. I do. I'm in men's groups. I do men's retreats. I'm in contact with several men on a daily, weekly basis to talk about these issues. I'm having trouble in how we talk about them.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of issues and challenges within the group of men, which is a very large and diverse group. It's even hard to call it a group because it's a group containing a lot of different subgroups and individuals and complexity. But it's hard for me to go into a constructive dialogue with a door that says toxic masculinity, because there already it's filled with shame and it's almost like it's accusing. It has a sense of pointing fingers at individual men or groups of men. And I don't think that's the way to go. I believe in doing the work. I believe in as a man, as a brother, as a partner, as a friend, as a man in this society, to take huge responsibility for my actions. I believe in doing work with other men, supporting them. I believe in supporting my sisters and women doing their work as well. But in the midst of all this, I'm having a hard time with that concept, with that wording.
There are a lot of people that are having a difficult time with that wording. And I've had the opportunity to dialogue about that, especially since the TED Talk, because of the way that it was titled.
Mm.
And you know, the perceived main subject matter. And where I'm at with it is when I'm referring to toxic masculinity or whatever someone chooses to identify or label, as soon as that word comes out or that phrase comes out, it's like throwing a hand grenade into a room.
Yeah.
And people get defensive. And when I'm speaking about that issue, and I'm talking about myself, I'm coming from the I perspective, it is not an attack on men. It's not an attack on manhood, and it's not an attack on an entire gender. It is a discussion to be opened about aspects that traditionally, in my experience, are attached to things that are attached to malehood that oftentimes for myself, I was blind to their negative connotations to other people and insensitivity to other people around me. For instance, if me and you are standing out somewhere and a young lady walks down the street and I make a comment about what's going on underneath her skirt to you, maybe I don't say it to her, but I say it in such a way that potentially she heard it. And even if she didn't hear, I say it to you and you just, you know, look at me and you shrug it off or you look and you agree. That is something that traditionally goes on. I've experienced it. You know, I can't say what anybody else has experienced. That is something that frame of mind and me speaking it and somebody else passively allowing it to go, that's something that contributes to a toxic environment. That's why we have in the world today, women, you know, as a whole often are uncomfortable walking down the street by themselves and they see a group of men. And those men may mean them absolutely no harm, but because of history, because of experiences of women and other men, seeing a group of men, it kind of incites a hair on the back of the neck sort of thing, like a pack of dogs. One man by himself is not dangerous, but a group of men, that pack mentality may come out. Those are the things that, you know, I support conversation about addressing and bringing to the forefront that we may be unconscious to and unaware of, because those are toxic aspects of my masculinity in the past that I know contributed to people feeling unsafe. And it didn't necessarily have anything to do with me putting my hands on them or aggressing on them in any, you know, sort of way. And it's not just a women thing. It can be masculinity in general. It could be something out on the on a football field or a basketball court. You know, we had a famous coach here in this country. Bobby Knight was a basketball coach. He's a highly celebrated and highly regarded basketball coach. And he had some incidences that came out about how he treated his male players to get the best out of them. You know, there were some incidents with screaming and name calling and choking. That is, you know, him in his mind building up men, making them stronger men, making them, you know, building up their masculinity. That's toxic. The word toxic could be put on that in conversation. It's not an attack where I'm coming from on men or on manhood or indicting, you know, somebody for being born, you know, with a penis and a scrotum. That is not where I'm coming from at all. It's the opening for a conversation about things that maybe I'm unaware of, that I'm unaware of things that I do or that I allow to go down and am silent to, that I just, as a man, take for granted. Because there are let me backtrack. As a male, take for granted, because I also believe that a man, there are things that a man just will not put up with. There are things that a man will not go for, but a male will. There's a big difference between a male and a man in my mind.
Right. So I totally agree with the challenges and with the problems. And also the negative aspects, or I would say the immature aspects of masculinity. What I don't agree with is the word toxic, and I think that's a really bad conversation starter. I mean, if you want to address something that's triggered, sensitive, traumatic, and unconscious, maybe the door to that conversation shouldn't be labeled with the word toxic. I wouldn't go through that door. I know a lot of men who would become very defensive, and I don't find that word to be constructive to start the conversation off, as I don't think the word racist is a good conversation starter to discuss racism. So that's where I'm coming from. I think we should we would be able to have more conversations on the immature aspects of masculinity if we didn't use the word toxic, because that stops us from actually going where the problem is. And there's a lot of problems, and there's a lot of things we could do better as men, as individuals, but also as a group of men, or small groups, or tribes of men. But that word puts a stop to it, and it stops, I think, a lot of men from actually listening to what's going on, and the fear that women have of groups of men, that fear that men have of groups of men. I mean, I remember the first time I went into a weekend where we're with the Mankind Project, doing a weekend of men's work for the very first time in my life. I was, I think, maybe 30 years old. I just had a daughter, and I was really confused on the aspect of masculinity. What kind of man am I supposed to be? I didn't have any positive role models. So when I went into that retreat, when I went into that weekend, the first thing I was confronted with was a group of men, 50 men that I didn't know. And my first reaction to that was, is this leading to a fight? I mean, my gut reaction was to look at all those men and to measure them and to calculate who I would hit first. That was my first gut reaction. So no, I don't have a sense of like natural safety or I don't feel totally safe with groups of men until maybe now, like 10 years later, doing a lot of work, actually realizing that I don't need to feel threatened or compete with other men. I see them as my brothers. But that took me 7 years of building trust. And I think that's a hard thing to do when you feel defensive or feel attacked.
And I don't disagree with that. And me personally, I'm not married to any particular word. I'm not married to the word toxic. I'm open to that conversation, whatever it looks like to get people in the room.
Yeah.
And having done the work that I've done and continuing to do the work that I do, the question that I would ask someone who is triggered by the word toxic is, where does that come from? Because if we're talking about, and we're talking about toxic masculinity and using that as an example, if we're talking about toxic masculinity and someone brings that to me, if I'm confident that you're not talking about me or I'm not engaging in the things that might be labeled that doesn't trigger me because you're not talking about me. Yes, I'll engage in the conversation. That's just like if we took, you know, you use a racism, a racist. If there's a conversation about that, I wouldn't be uncomfortable talking about that because I'm not racist. So I don't have anything to defend. It's not going to be something that triggers me or puts me back on my heels. And I understand that language is very powerful and it can trigger people. So then again, for me, the invitation would be, where does that come from? Let's get away now from the conversation about toxic masculinity. What is it that triggers or brings up some sort of fear or defensiveness in you behind this particular word?
Right.
Or behind this particular language? Now let's have a conversation about that.
That's a good point. So for that question to not only be rhetorical, I'm going to try to answer that. I would say, I feel that one of the reasons that the word toxic might trigger me is that there's already so much self-hate. and chaos inside of me, that that word is I think it might trigger the self-loathing and the self-hate that's already there. And that creates a trigger or almost an anger inside of
me. Yes.
And that when that triggers that self-hate, then that takes over a lot of focus, and I put in a lot of energy to still that rumbling inside, and I'm not in my full capacity to take feedback.
Yeah. So on that point, and without going off into a deep process, if then my answer is, when I hear the word toxic, it brings up my own self-loathing, and it brings up anger and distaste that I have for myself. Then I would be looking for, okay, so when I'm in a place that I'm feeling my self-loathing and I'm feeling anger and I'm feeling distaste for myself, how do I then treat myself and others when I'm in that place? So then there's another level of the self introspection. How am I treating others when I'm in that place? Historically, how have I treated others? How have I shown up in the world when I'm coming from that place of self-loathing?
Yeah.
How does that project out onto the world? And are there any toxic aspects there that project out and affect other people?
Yep. Yeah. Gotcha.
So see, it's not for me personally, it's not the word. The word ain't shit to me. Because if you ain't talking about me, and if I really believe you ain't talking about me with a word, it doesn't offend me. It doesn't trigger anything with me. And I'm there and I'm able and present to be able to have a conversation. But then if there's something there that when I hear it, I'm automatically like, oh no, I don't want nothing to do with that. Then I got to start asking myself, well, how come? What is it about that? What is it? What's this mirror showing me about myself that I don't even want to go there? Because my experience with this work tells me that when I don't want to go someplace, that's exactly where I need to go.
Oh yeah. I totally connect with that. And I also love the fact that you mirrored me in that way, because that got me to think. What I'm hearing is, invite the triggers to the conversation.
Yes.
Bring those triggers inside the room and let's talk about them. I love that.
If we never have the conversation, then we never get there. We never get to any solutions. We never find any common ground. And if it's the word toxic, you know, and it's attached to masculinity, and you got an issue with that, you know, as a man, as a male, as whatever you are, we'll come to the table and let's discuss it. Let's talk about it.
Yeah.
And let's talk about it with people who are affected by what we've come to be known as that. Just like if we're talking about racism, let's don't just have a bunch of black people sitting in the room talking about racism, or let's don't just have a bunch of white people sitting in the room talking about how we, you know, come up with solutions for racism, or let's don't just have Muslims sitting in the room, you know, or Christians, or get everybody and get the people in the room, get the people involved in the dialogue who are affected by it in different ways, because then I can begin to understand the things that I don't know. There are things that I take for granted in my life because of my culture, because of my background, because of my upbringing, that have effects on other people who were raised in a different culture, in a different background, that have different experiences. And I'm unaware of that. And as long as I'm unaware of that, I will continue to show up in the world and have potentially a negative effect on people that I'm unconscious to. So I am open at this point in my life to wake my conscience up to those things that I don't know, so that I can become a more well-rounded and informed person. And then the choices that I make can have a different purpose, and I can show up in a different way. Now, if I continue to want to be an asshole to somebody, then that's a choice. before, maybe I was ignorant and didn't know that what I was doing was being perceived as an asshole. But now I have the information. And if that's how I want to show up in the world, I'm making an informed decision.
Conscious assholiness. Sounds like a self-help book. I've seen the reactions to the work documentary in Sweden and in my circles and among my friends. But I'm really curious on how it has affected your life as well. I mean, the work that you do in that documentary is not limited to that one time. It's something you've been doing for quite some time now. But that weekend or those 4 days were caught on tape and made into this really touching and moving and inspiring documentary, which have opened the eyes of many men and women around me. But how have the reactions been on your side? What has the responses been like?
Generally, the responses have been positive. I hear a lot. I hear the word inspirational a lot. I hear powerful a lot. It's provided a gateway for us to be able to go into different arenas and do this work and bring this work. Like I mentioned before, you know, we're getting the opportunity now to work with at-risk youth. We're getting the opportunity to work with corporate America and help them look at, you know, themselves and the way that they're doing business. We're doing community events now. We're it's co-ed. Now we do these circles with men and women together in the community. And it's, again, for me, it's very humbling because people see it. And I often hear, oh, you were, you know, what you did or what you said, it affected me, or you were very powerful. And my response is always, you know, that's not me that you see in that film. That is my body. But that is me knowing how to get the hell out of the way and allow spirit to come in and do what it does. Because I don't know anything. You know, and the individuals who are being facilitated, they have the answers within them. As a facilitator, all I'm doing is just asking a few questions and feeding back to you what it is that you're providing me and helping you gain a way to stay clear as you travel your path. That's not, you know, I'm not doing anything that anybody else can't do, you know, utilizing effective communication. And whatever you see that you think is special or powerful or magical or anything like that, what you're seeing is spirit using me. You're seeing spirit, you know, use me as a tool. I just know how to, you know, I've gotten to a point in my life where I know how to get the hell out of the way and not let my ego come into play.
One of the men who touched me during the documentary was Dante. How is he? Are you still in contact?
Yes, sir. I'm still in contact with him, and he is he's doing well. He is now actually eligible for parole a whole lot sooner than he was at the time of that filming. Some laws have changed. And more laws are changing, so he may be eligible even sooner. As it stands right now, I believe in the next 7 years or so, he'd be eligible to see about coming home. He's gained his GED. Oh, wow. He's been engaging in several vocational trainings to up his, you know, learning and ability to be a productive citizen. When they do allow him to return back into society, he's been able to maintain a relationship with his son. Mm-hmm. His son actually just turned 18 2 years ago. He's doing well. He's doing well. He's in a lot better place than he was at the time of that filming.
I'm so happy to hear. So you got your 3 months.
I got my 3 months.
You asked
him
for
yes,
3 months and you got your 3 months. Good.
Yes.
I'm so
yes.
happy to hear that. And I'm also curious about you. I mean, you've done a lot of work both in when you were in solitary and in Inside Circle and also through the work where you facilitate other men. I mean, you grow through that work as well. What are you still struggling with?
What I am still struggling with is projection. I am still struggling with being institutionalized for more of my life than I've been out in the community. There are things that I got used to in being incarcerated. Basically from the time I was 14 until I was in my 40s, learning how to deal with people in interpersonal relationships. That's a difficult one for me. And more specifically, when I speak about that, I'm talking about, you know, learning how to be in good relation with my wife. Because I'm used to, you know, living in a cell, living with another person. And again, there are rules, there are guidelines, there's a structure, there's a way things go. We both understand that. And it's going to go that way or there's going to be some fucking consequences, as opposed to living, you know, with a partner and a very strong and powerful woman and learning how to compromise and learning how to give and take and not, you know, taking things personally and not, you know, projecting the same sort of things onto her or onto actions that I would have projected onto, you know, something or action or a person for so long in my life. That for me is a struggle. It's work for me to do every day.
Right. And how old are your kids?
14 and... The youngest will be 4 on April 4th, on April 1st.
14 and 4.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that I struggle with that is challenging for me is being a father and trying to, I mean, bring with me the positive aspects of my father and also forgiving him for the negative aspects of his fatherhood. How do you reconcile with that?
Well, I'm fortunate enough to still have my father in my life today. My parents live like 12 minutes away.
Oh, wow.
So they actually get the opportunity to babysit their grandson two times a week. And the relationship that I have with my father today is an extraordinary one. He's, you know, one of my best friends and he's a guide, he's a mentor. And, what I have come to be able to reconcile from my upbringing and what I try and pass on to my youngsters is how to be yourself and how to have discipline, but I'm not trying to make them be who I want them to be or who I think that they should be. I'm learning how to give them space to learn and grow and develop and have their characters flourish within safe confines. I'm not trying to pigeonhole them into anything. I'm hard, but I don't think that I'm as much as a disciplinarian as my father was in that area. In the era that I grew up in, you know, things are just different today. You know, we have more knowledge today. We have more tools available today. I communicate with my kids in a way that I think was different than the way my father and his father communicated with him. You know, I tell them how much I love them, you know, on a constant and consistent basis. We're always hugging and kissing. There's always, you know, physical touch so that you know, but amongst males, amongst men, is not something that's foreign to them or strange or has some sort of negative connotations to it.
I mean, that's huge. Just that part is really, it's a big change throughout generations. And also when I listen to your TED talk, you share the fact that you cry, and you let your children be there and see you cry, and sometimes even comfort you or trust hold you when you cry.
Yeah.
I mean, those are not small things.
Yeah. I view them as necessary. I view them as a necessary part of becoming a well-rounded human. Forget becoming a well-rounded man, of becoming a well-rounded human. You know, my youngest, the 4-year-old, his heart is, he's something else. You know, if he sees somebody in pain or hurt or something like that, you know, he's coming and tending to you and dabbing at your eyes and talking about, come on, let's cuddle. And yeah, he's amazing.
That's beautiful. Yeah. And also, I mean, the whole thing about crying, I talk a lot about crying and grief and sadness with my friends, and especially my male friends and in the men's groups we have, and how hard it is to be able to show that emotion, to show sadness, to cry, and not explaining yourself, not trying to know why you're crying, and just letting the tears out. So me and my daughter, we have a rule at our house that you don't need to explain your tears. That's one of our house rules. So you can cry and you don't need to know why. But what I've heard through my upbringing, through my childhood, was those exact sentences that you talk about in the beginning of your TED talk. That's nothing to cry about. Or I'll show you something to cry about.
Yeah.
Or boys don't cry.
Yeah.
And those sentences, though, they stick with you. And even if I'm another person. I've done a lot of work. I've managed to get over some of those obstacles. But I can still hear those sentences in my head. On a rainy day, it's a lot of negative chatter going on.
Yeah. You know, it's in doing this work, you know, I've become familiar with the fact that there are things that I'm resigned to the fact that there are things that will probably never go away. But what I can do is continue to grow in my awareness and ability to manage those things so that they don't crop up and run the show.
Yeah.
Because they're so deeply embedded and they're just so ingrained that, I mean, short of a lobotomy, they're not going anywhere. But I can manage them, and I can make certain that I can do my best not to pass my stuff, my baggage on to the next generation. And perhaps equip them with the tools so that they then don't pass whatever baggage they do pick up onto the generation following them.
Right. So the key word is awareness, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Like previously in our conversation, while we were talking about the whole triggering part, I mean, you're going to have triggers, right? But the result of your life will be according to how you relate or how aware you are when those triggers come up.
Very much so. Very much so. Triggers will not go away. You know, they are a part of life. And as an example, you know, something very simple, you know, road rage, traffic, you're getting cut off in traffic. You know, that happens to me often now. And I work in a field where I deal with traffic, where I deal with drivers for a living. So I get to see the worst in drivers and people not paying attention and being on their phone and just being careless and reckless. And so when I'm then personally driving a vehicle and something like that happens, for me, that is a trigger. Mm. And where I'm at today, I'm able to recognize that. I might, you know, inside of my car, you know, I might call him a name. I might, you know, get agitated over the act because now I'm playing a situation in my head that didn't occur, where there was a horrible accident and my whole family died and all of that sort of stuff. But I'm not chasing somebody down. I'm not trying to catch up with somebody and cuss them out and flip them off or run them off the side of the road or blow their brains out. And there was a time in my life where that sort of thing would have triggered that sort of response in me. Yeah. Because you just cut me off. You just disrespected me. You don't know who the hell I believe in my mind I am. So I have to show you and the world who I am. And I got to do it in a big grand fashion. And everybody will see it on the 6 o'clock news. Yeah. It's the same trigger. The trigger is still there. Mm-hmm. I just manage it in a very different way.
Yeah. I mean, even calling it a trigger is aware.
Yes.
Because otherwise you would call it just like it is. I mean, that guy's an idiot.
Yeah.
But if you think about, you know, the concept of being triggered, you're already a little bit more aware.
I'm already making it about me. I'm already taking responsibility for what it is that I feel and not projecting, you know, what's going on with me onto somebody else and making it their fault.
Right. So what's on the horizon? What are your future projects or aspirations?
Future projects are continuing to do outside circle events. We have one coming up in Frisco in February. We'll have one down in Los Angeles in March. This evening, I fly out on a red eye to New Jersey to go into a youth facility. My aspirations really are to be able to get in a position to be able to do this work full time, to be able to walk away from what I'm doing, you know, to earn a paycheck today, to be able to have our nonprofit, be able to hire a few of us so that we can really ramp up and take this work into the world, you know, full force.
Right. So I would love for you guys to come to Sweden. I would love to help you and support you in any way I can to set up a retreat or a weekend or a workshop. Just let me know if there's any possibility to have you as our guests anytime soon.
Will do. What I'll do is I'll connect you onto the thread where we have people in Europe who are talking and conversing about how to make it happen and get resources pooled together.
Yeah. That's a good thing. Then we can coordinate that and maybe do some kind of tour or a bigger arrangement. That would be awesome. And are you still doing this twice a year thing that you did in documentary in Folsom?
It is still occurring in Folsom. Yes, it is. It still occurs 2 to 3 times a year.
2 to 3 times a year.
And that's also
something I would love to participate in.
And we're looking to expand into Jamestown right now. I now have a brown card, which is basically I'm a volunteer staff person going back into prison. I'm going into Jamestown prison. We want to bring it there. We want to take this global.
But you should.
We got to start small. But my aspirations have always been huge and grandiose. the goal is to take this global.
Yeah, I would love to help. Just tell me anything I could help with. I have a huge community of men in Sweden and Scandinavia as well who will gladly help.
Okay. Well, we're in contact now. We have a better, you know, feel of who we are now. We will continue to communicate and work on that.
I would love that. Perfect. So, brother, let's round this off. We've been doing almost 90 minutes, I think.
Okay.
And I would love for us to check you out.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah.
I'll start. Elder Jackson III, spirit named Peaceful Bobcat, and I am checking out feeling energized. And the emotion that I would attach that to, once again, is joy and sadness. And the joy is obvious in being able to sit here, you know, with another great soul and have an open dialogue about things, you know, from a truthful and honest perspective. Anytime that opportunity presents itself, I feel at home. So I feel at home with you. You are a brother, and Jill, you are a sister. And the sadness is that more people aren't doing this. There's a sadness that I know what's possible, and I know that it's not happening on the scale in which it can. And with that, I'm out.
Thank you. I feel inspired. I feel grateful to be able to connect with you. I've seen you on the screen, and I had that image of you, and now I have you. Like the depth of you and more of your story and more of your emotions and energy. And I'm really grateful to be able to connect to that. And also I feel energized and challenged through our conversation with the triggers and with the stuff that you invited me to look at and to think about. And I realize I still have so much stuff to do and so many things to learn. And that's a nice thing to be aware of, on a beautiful Sunday like this. I feel the pain. I feel a lot of sadness and pain as well. Because of all the men I know, suffering from loneliness and disattachment and not being able to be with themselves. So I sense that as well within me and within the men I've met. So with that, I'm out. Thank you. So brother, in the end of every episode, we invite our guests to recommend someone that they think we should have on the podcast, someone they want us to invite to the How Can We podcast. Who do you think we should meet and talk to?
Dr. James McCleary.
Dr. James McCleary.
Dr. James McCleary. And I can connect you all. You may, I don't know if you'll recognize the name, but you've seen the movie a few times. He's the man in the beginning who does the chant.
Oh, wow. Yes.
And he's been doing this work for close to 40 years now. He's a retired clinical psychologist, forensic psychologist, and he's one of my huge mentors. He's, you know, huge in the MKP community and has been there from the beginning of the inception of Inside Circle and continues to work with us today. And the breadth of knowledge and wealth of stories. I mean, he's a shaman who was initiated into that order down in the jungles of South America. He's, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Born and raised on the south side of Chicago, you know, walked away from a criminal lifestyle to go on to, you know, get his doctorate. And yeah, he's a hell of a guy.
I would love to connect with him. I would love to have him on. So okay. Please.
I will make that connection. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yes, sir.
All right, brother. Thank you so much for this conversation. I hope it's the first of many. And I really hope that you continue with your work, with yourself and with other men, other people as well. I'm really inspired and touched by what you do.
Thank you very much. It's been a humbling honor and a pleasure.
So take care now, and I hope to talk to you soon.
Be well.
Bye.